call the meeting to order. We're going to have a time crunch here today because we got to get out of here at 11:30.
We can't hear you.
The first bill on the agenda is Representative Clark's bill. Since she's not a member, I would move Senate File 1272 to be before the committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We heard this bill last year, but there is an amendment to bring down the cost. And I would move the DE2 amendment. And then, Representative Clark, would you like to explain your amendment first, and then we can have testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, thank you for doing the amendment. It does reduce the cost because it combines the opportunities with that we had just before limited to certain local units of government or to certain nonprofits. It puts them together and allows there to be some competition between those various factors. I would like our witness to explain that. It was quite a group of people who came together to figure out how to make this work. And so that's what I'm bringing before you, something that I think will actually really work and reduce the cost. So if I could...
Okay.
Mr. Walson.
Mr. Hansen.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Zach Hansen. I'm the Environmental Health Director for St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health. I'm testifying today in support of this bill on behalf of the local Public Health Association of Minnesota, which represents city, county, and tribal health, public health departments across Minnesota. I have 3 points about this bill today. The first is that there is a clear connection between housing and health. Our local experience in Ramsey County and St. Paul and the suburban area, over 2 decades of work on lead hazard reduction, is that by working in the home or in the house, we've been able to reduce lead exposure and reduce the incidence of childhood lead poisoning. We've used a similar approach by working in housing for kids with severe asthma, and these are kids that typically will use the emergency department or have to be hospitalized because of severe asthma. We found by partnering with others and using some federal grants as well as state grants is that we were able to go into housing, work with the family, provide low-cost interventions in the home, and see statistically significant reductions in emergency department visits, hospitalizations, statistically significant increases in kids returning to school, as well as parents working. In that healthy homes approach, we've also addressed radon, mold, exposure to chemical poisoning, and injury prevention in the house by taking a whole homes approach. My second point, and probably of most interest to this committee, is that there's a significant economic relationship between housing and health. I think it's been well established in the literature by preventing childhood lead poisoning, you can increase IQ points and increase the predictive ability of that child as they move through life. We've also seen through our window replacement program, which is the principal means we work through reducing exposure to lead, is that we can increase the property value of the housing as well as reduce energy costs at the same time we're preventing lead exposure. These kids have better futures as a result of this intervention in the home. As well as common sense, you know that managing cases like asthma through an emergency department or hospitalization or special office visit is probably the most expensive way to manage asthma. Our work with partnering with Minneapolis, the American Lung Association, the State Health Department, has allowed us to show that a preventive homes approach reduces the need for that expensive treatment. We also know that addressing other hazards in the home in this way, in a preventive way, can also reduce costs. So my final point, this bill provides support for collaborative approaches to healthy homes, provides training and outreach throughout the state of Minnesota, and builds capacity at the state and local level to take this preventive approach forward. This is a common sense approach, provides efficiency at the local level to staying safe and allowing people to stay in their homes and be safe and healthy. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, you know, you're hitting lead, and I know when I was in elementary school, it was a big thing. And at what year did we stop allowing lead to be in paints?
1978, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Knowing that LGA formula biases towards communities with older homes, I don't think we've ever looked at having some of that earmarked for removing lead and improving. And since that formula is meant to take into account that you've got older, I just would like the members to think about maybe trying to earmark some of these funds that are going to the communities for this kind of a program, and have each community with these houses and this portion of their market that's damaging to the kids start to address it, and not just have it driven by the state.
Okay. Other comments, questions?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say one thing, maybe somewhat related to your comment. If you'll notice on page 3, line 3.6, one of the things that the commissioner is encouraged to do here is to geographically balance the distribution of grant funding, and that's what they've been really good at, and including in lead poisoning and in other areas. And this work has been very much a statewide initiative, and that's why the local governments are involved here as well as the local health departments. So I just want to mention that is a conscious effort in this bill to make sure that there's a lot of geographical distribution of the resources, limited as they are, Mr. Chairman. I think this bill is like a third of what we originally requested, but we know it still would be a very good investment.
Well, my home is built in 1922. So. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I'm late, and I don't want to repeat what everybody said, but I just wanted to throw my support behind this effort. I've worked on this in the past as well. I don't have the local challenges that Representative Clark does and these older homes, but, you know, when these kids get exposed to this lead and it gets in their brain, it is over for their upside potential, and it's just tragic, and so the more we can do, the better, and thanks for working on this, and I hope that you get successful along the way. Thanks.
Thank you.
Do you... Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I notice $100,000 is specific for lead prevention. Is the second portion, the $400,000 for general grants that could mitigate any number of things, including radon and some of the rest of it, depending on the application?
Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, that's true.
Okay, thank you. I think this is certainly something I can get behind, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. Hansen? If not, we'll go to the next testifier, Judy Deming. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jude Deming. I'm the housing manager at Heartland Community Action in Wilmer, Minnesota. I manage the weatherization program as well as low-income conservation improvement programs for 9 utilities in Wilmer. I'm here to support the House Bill 1445. The Weatherization Assistance Program is an energy conservation program that also addresses environmental health and safety issues in the home. We are in the homes of the low-income, the elderly, families every day. We see the direct link between health of a home and the health of children, families, and elderly people living in those homes. We try to address lead, radon, pests, and other issues that are brought to our attention. With very limited funding, we can only address a handful of measures, and generally those are measures that are related to capturing energy savings. There are some homes that we must walk away from, and that means we cannot provide services due to state regulations. Homes with vermiculite or asbestos insulation, inaccessible spaces, or excessive moisture issues are ineligible to receive benefits. Portland's current walkaway percentage is at 48%. Because we have such a high walkaway percentage, we've started doing pre-audits, which is when the auditors go to the home and just do a very quick check for anything that would lead us to walk away from that home, rather than scheduling a 4 to 5 hour audit and then having to walk away and not know what to do with the rest of your day. So we're at 48% walk away. There are homes that need the most, and these homes are the ones that need the most corrective action. I believe that the benefits of investing in healthy housing not only directly impact the individuals living in the homes, but have social benefits such as reducing emergency room visits, improved quality housing, increased attendance at school and work, and reduced overall health care costs. While we do not have funds today to support Healthy Homes Initiative, my organization has already started reaching out to other institutions investing in this area. To date, Heartland has hosted two meetings with public health officials, local utility companies, Minnesota Department of Health, local contractors, asbestos contractors, and state representatives. The purpose of these meetings is to form a coalition of partners that can address healthy homes from the home an individual lives in to their behavior in that home. What prohibits us from moving forward with implementing Healthy Homes Initiative in our community is the funding. If funded, we would be particularly interested in grant funds to identify and correct structural issues and increase community collaboration.
Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony, and we have one more, Jean Lee. Welcome to the committee.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, that does legal advocacy, public policy, R and R Family Centers, that does shelters, transitional permanent housing and services, and APAC, which is a housing consortium. I'll be short and sweet. Most people will agree, I'm sure, maybe not so sweet. We totally support Representative Clark's Senate File 1272. The intent for a healthy Minnesota and healthier Minnesotans is laudable, and this is a very good start, bill to start with. But I'm also part of the Alliance for Healthy Homes and Communities, and I'm also in the state and national health impact assessment coalitions, where we seek to consider the impact of health on all legislation. Regarding subdivision 4 under section 1 and 2, as a former corporate auditor and on legal advocacy cases that we and other organizations have handled, I do know and I've handled cases where local agencies use code enforcement officers to do penalties and incarceration of people as a method to comply. A city employee that had told our alliance members that he intended to use this method of code enforcement to force residents to fix up their homes that they were living in. And he encouraged other members, including county members, to do the same. Their intent was to use home visitors. Now, for low-income people, seniors, and others not knowledgeable about the processes, and with no income to comply, and who don't get donated materials and funds, the use of code enforcement, the legal problems and the repercussions, evictions and foreclosures, will actually create a worse health situation that's going to end up costing cities and counties and state more money in other costs in other areas, including higher health care costs. The solutions that are needed are grants for residents who need to be in compliance, which probably, I'm sorry, you reduced the funding in the bill because it needs more money. They need donated funds, donated materials and labor and other assistance, and extensions of time to comply. Now, Representative Loon spoke of legislators being able to volunteer their time in the evenings. So this might be a project that they can help with. And I have something very easy for everyone to start with, which is a pen. And I'll be happy to get you all signed up. But most importantly is to pass this bill with protections needed. Now, I think under line 2.29 on page 2, if you were to add non-punitive activities, that might kind of direct local agencies not to use code enforcement and punitive methods and you know, the cities, counties on that other track. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I don't see any. Representative Clark, I will renew my motion that the DE2 amendments be approved.
Thank you.
Any discussion of that? This is the amendment that reduces the cost dramatically. And so I don't see any discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the amendment is adopted. And then do you have any final comments, Representative Clark?
I'd like to read a quote to you. You know, the Minnesota Department of Health has recently looked at the issue of structural racism, and some of the issues that have to do with healthy housing really do disproportionately impact low-income communities and communities of color and tribal communities. And this is a quote from page 31 of their manual where they talked about advancing health equity, and it is, housing is essential for health. Having a safe, stable place to live is as important as nutritious food for protecting and maintaining health. So I really urge us to do this, both to help them keep their commitment and because I think it's the right thing to do, and I appreciate the support of the committee.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry to prolong this a little bit, but so members on line 2.30 of the bill, you see a subdivision 4, which calls for the Commissioner of Health to develop and implement standards for the toxicity levels of mold. Representative Clark put this in at my request because I came to my attention a couple years ago that we have no statewide standard for mold in housing, and it's a real issue. It came from a constituent of mine who tried to fight an eviction proceeding by withholding money, you know, under the procedure, and went to court and had the judge say, I can't help you, you're not allowed to withhold rent for this because there is no standard for mold, even though his house was full of mold. So this has been a concern of mine for a while, and Representative Clark, when I explained it to her, shared that concern, but it turns out there's some practical problems with it, and I'd like the Department of Health to come down and just talk a bit to the committee about what those problems are, because I think it's a really serious issue. And yet, they've asked me to make a motion to remove this, which I am willing to do, but I did want them to address it because I think it's a really serious issue for all of our constituents, like the idea that people may have their housing full of mold and there's no standard and they have essentially may not have any recourse. So if it would be okay, I'd like the Assistant Commissioner to address that.
Commissioner.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and with me is Dale Dorschner from our Environmental Health Division. And what we'd like to do is talk about the difficulty in establishing a standard and also some alternatives that actually are kind of included in this bill that may get us to a similar place. So it's just clarifying the work that we're doing and what would be the most practical path to follow to get to healthier homes that are mold-free, or at least the harm of mold has been mitigated. So I'm going to ask Dale to speak to it because I'm about an inch deep, and I've gone as far as I can.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Dale Dorschner with the Minnesota Department of Health, Environmental Health. Mr. Chair, the concerns are really, we share the concerns, I guess. It's our number of calls that come into our indoor air unit right behind radon. So we understand that it's a significant issue, and it can be a health issue for those that are susceptible to mold. The concern or the complexity is that mold is a growing organism. And a lot of the allergens come off when it's sporulating at some point in its growing stage, and that usually happens under environmental conditions, moisture being the prime environmental issue. So the concern that we have is if we develop a toxic standard based on a numerical value that I think is what most people want, is that you could get a lot of false positives. So you could have visible mold growing on the wall, and if you took a sample, you wouldn't necessarily detect it because it's in a dormant stage. With that said, we worked long and hard on this, and we worked with the University of Minnesota on developing what we thought could be a very practical way of dealing with a very complex issue, and that is we have a standard at the department that no visible mold growth should be tolerated in indoor environments. And so if you see it, you should clean it, and you should identify the moisture issue that's allowing it to be there in the first place. And that has been nationally adopted. California, and Texas both have tried to do standards, and they revert back to the practical method because that is actually more protective. What we could do under the Healthy Homes is develop some guidance. So for local public health to use their nuisance orders and use some guidance from the health department that the visible indoor mold is not tolerated and it can be a health and have cause some health issues. So I think it would distract from all the other issues and use a considerable amount of resources to get around the toxicity standards and get to probably a numeric value that people would want. And I don't think it serves much public health value.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that. You know, and it wasn't my intention to, put on the department some very expensive and put in Representative Clark's bill a very expensive and maybe not workable requirement. But so if I could just ask, so in order to say the standard then was going to be no visible mold, in say, in a rental unit, is that something that we need to do in law, or is that a standard that can be promulgated by the department? I guess I'm asking whether we should just be amending this language or, you know, how we should proceed with that, because I don't want to, I just found it to be really pretty shocking that there was no standard and that municipalities, you know, local units of government, some, I don't know if any of them have rules, but that people have no recourse if there's mold in their rental unit.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I reiterate that the department, if we could develop standards, we would have, because that would help us quite a bit. I think when you say standards, that usually means that there's some legal defensible numerical value that can. A judge can say, we found this, it's above the standard, and so you need to mitigate it. And so in going to a more practical of visible mold growth should not be tolerated in indoor environments really has over the last 15 years tested in different states to be the standard of what we need to do. So I would hate to have in the bill some level of expectation that the department would develop a standard that alludes to that there will be a numerical value and go back to the toxicity and measure. I think that's not where we want to go.
Well, Representative Liebling. Representative Clark has a comment.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I've read at length what the department has to say about testing for mold. And I think we heard the testifier from Wilmer also talk about the fact that when people have moisture in their home and there's no help, as in the case of Representative Liebling's constituent, insurance companies may not cover it at all. This is a very serious health issue, especially in homes. Like when we start having warmer weather and we start having some leaking and a lot of dripping through some of the older homes through the ceilings and so on and down into the basements, we're going to run into this again. And the problem is, although already the department does say the MDH recommends assuming that any visible amount of mold may potentially cause illness and advises that the best approach is to remove this potential threat as soon as it can be done safely. That is a standard. And I would, if that's what the standard needs to say, then that's what we should have it say. That there, I mean, I just think having nothing in the law is a problem. I think I agree with Representative Liebling that maybe there's a way to say it that could be a little more accurate, given the you know already what your advice is. But I just think having nothing in the standard leaves our homeowners, our renters, without any recourse when insurance companies say, "Too bad, you got the mold there. It's making you sick. Too bad, there's no standard." So I think we have to do something that actually addresses it in law.
Representative Clark and Representative Liebling, you know, we're just going to lay this over for possible inclusion, and that would give you time to work with the department to get the correct language in there.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And so at this time, I think, you know, I will keep my end of the bargain with the department and move that we strike lines 2.30 to 2.31, which is this subdivision 4 line, but with the understanding that we will continue to work on this, and I really do appreciate Representative Clark's attention to this, and I hope that everybody understands and agrees that this is a serious health issue. So I would make that motion, Mr.
Chair. So Representative Liebling has moved we delete lines 230 and 231. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and yeah, that's right. So with that, I will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus health and human services bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
Next is Representative Liebling. Yeah. And just to remind folks, we've only got 40 more minutes to go here.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this should be fairly quick. And this is House File 1897, so I assume it would be the chair's intention to lay this over for possible inclusion. Okay, so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to let my testifiers talk, and I will be quiet.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Chair Huntley and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota. And I had to move the chair back. I didn't care whether you could see me or not, but I'd get complaints from representatives if you couldn't see Kurt when he testifies. So I wanted to make sure that we had that taken care of. And I'm co-chair of the State Quality Council, and I was hoping that our other co-chair, Lance Hagelin, who's a self-advocate, was here to testify, but he's ill. So Kurt has volunteered to read Lance's testimony, and we'll try to keep our testimony brief. Before we get to Kurt, though, I just wanted to say that we do have some other State Quality Council board members here. John Jordan from La Crescent, Les Bauer from Richfield, Alex Bartolik, who's director of the Disability Services Division, is also on the State Quality Council, and Jerry Kerber, our Inspector General, also serves on the State Quality Council. And I'm going to be available at the end of the testimony to answer any questions about the bill specifically. And with that, I'd like to introduce Kurt Rutzen, who is a volunteer with the ARC Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. As a person with a disability, I receive personal care assistance and case management services through the Minnesota Health Care Program. I'm also the co-chair for the Minnesota State Quality Council, where I represent the diverse perspectives of individuals and families experiencing chronic illness, disabilities, and aging. As a citizen with a disability and social entrepreneur, quality assurance and improvement throughout our independent living infrastructure is a deep passion of mine. Ensuring we are promoting self-direction, getting the biggest bang for each dollar today, while simultaneously investing in improvements for our future. Minnesota lacks a comprehensive, coordinated quality assurance system for their home in community-based services that encourages the voices of persons with disabilities to be heard. The Olmstead Plan highlights this too. To start to address this need, the State Quality Council was formed by the legislature in 2012 and has been hosted by DHS Disability Services Division since 2012. In March 2013, the Council issued its legislative report and recommendations, which include funding for our Council, the development of regional councils, plus the collection of important data and its review. See the bill summary for more. Ongoing funding was not allocated during the 2013 session, which is why we are here today. I would like to briefly highlight a few items in HF 1897. This language was initially passed in 2011 to create the State Quality Council. A few dates have been extended 1 year due to the lack of funding for fiscal year 2014. Starting on line 3.16, the Regional Quality Council language was updated. Starting on line 5.9, our 2 million funding request for fiscal year 2015 is highlighted, followed by specific expenditure categories for the funding request. At this time, I would like to pass the mic to my fellow testifiers, Cindy and Leanne. Thank you so much.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your time this morning. My name is Cindy Ostrowski, and I'm the CEO at Hiawatha Homes in Rochester, Minnesota. I have been supporting and advocating for people since 1989. Throughout these past 25 years, I've carried out a variety of roles, from providing direct support services, writing individualized support plans, supervising staff, directing quality assurance efforts, and I'm directing an agency that supports 140 people in our community, employs 380 staff. I am here today to tell you that regional quality assurance efforts, such as our Region 10 quality assurance effort and our Region 10 Quality Assurance Commission, and the person-driven quality assurance process known as VOICE, Value of Individual Choices and Experiences, has truly made a difference in the lives of people being supported. As a provider, through this process, we are evaluated on our service delivery, and we are licensed by this process that is person-driven. It focuses on the services and support that each person needs and each person wants in their life. This person, all of us who receive services, should be first. A quality measurement system or a licensing process should be focused on the needs of people in their life. This process does exactly that. Through a quality assurance process, which was developed by region stakeholders back in 1997, Hiawatha Homes staff are interviewed and we share information on how we provide services to people. Each provider the county case manager, the guardian, and everyone involved in the person's life, we all receive helpful feedback and constructive feedback on how we are providing support services. And if the person and their guardian is satisfied with the services and support we are providing, we are given very specific feedback about our services, and if there's something we are missing or something we could be doing better at to meet the person's need, the quality assurance team members involved in the interview process tell us how we could improve our services based upon what the person needs. Hiawatha Homes has used the voice review process as an educational tool for our staff. We have used the 8 life areas from voice to develop a life area plan for each person we support. This plan highlights what is most important to the person and how we can best support the person within these life areas. Hiawatha Homes also has 5 staff who are actively involved as quality assurance team members. Through this experience, they are able to travel to other counties and learn from other stakeholders in our region. This regional process assists us in identifying best practices throughout our region, but it also helps us identify barriers which might be getting in the way of people having a good quality of life. We are able to address these barriers at a local, regional, and state level. We must continue to fund the Region 10 Quality Assurance Commission, the State Quality Council, and the expansion of regional quality councils, as it is critical to build a person-driven quality assurance system that measures what is important to the person being supported. As a wise parent once told me, rules and regulations do not keep people safe. People keep people safe. Region 10 Quality Assurance System was developed and implemented by people in the region. Regional efforts do make a difference in providing safe and supportive environments. As a provider and a past quality assurance team member, I have firsthand knowledge of several quality assurance voice reviews that have made a positive difference in people's life. I thank you for your past support on regional efforts for people with disabilities, and I'm asking that we continue to do the right thing by expanding these regional efforts, which focus on the people using our services. Please support House File 1897 to continue to fund the Region 10 Quality Assurance Commission, the State Quality Council, and expansion of these regional efforts. We need to share these efforts in the rest of our great state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the best part? Outstanding. So let's go on to Leanne Bieber.
Yes, Bieber. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Leanne Bieber, and I am a parent with a child that has disabilities. I also sit, I am a state quality council member, and I work for Olmsted County in the developmental disabilities area. At Olmsted County, we focused for many years on the importance of quality in a person's life and all aspects of their life. We've done that recently through the Review Council, the Quality Assurance Review Council, which is our regional council. And as Cindy mentioned, the voice review process, that council looks at those reviews, not just singular, but as a provider, puts them all together and looks at them for quality, for consistency, for inconsistency, and is able to give that provider feedback on what they can do better and what they're doing very well. So that's the importance to that regional council in that way. The county is able to take that information as well and look at all providers together, where our strengths are in our region and where they can be improved. So then we can add resources, we can build on the resources we have, we can go from there. Olmsted County is also able to work with other counties to strengthen that throughout the region. The State Quality Council is then able to take all that information from our regional council, which they haven't done yet, obviously, but would be able to take that information and look at what the differences are across the state as far as consistencies, inconsistencies, good resources, things we can do differently. It is important for all people with disabilities to have the State Quality Council funded just for these reasons. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Sandy, so Representative Leland, do you have a final comment?
Well, I think this is a very valuable process, and I hope that the committee will be able to fund the expansion. I mean, this is, you know, we're talking about quality of life for individuals with disabilities, and this, I hope you've all kind of understood the point here. This is a different way of looking at quality, making sure that the individual is, you know, what's quality to one person might not be important to another person. And sometimes these can be issues that are big and small, but if we don't do a process where we actually include the person in it, we don't find that out. And so that's really the beauty of this thing, and it's been very effective in our area, and these folks are hoping to expand it. So thank you.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought you meant any questions for our testifier, but thank you for giving this opportunity. Representative Liebling, just a quick question on the end of your bill with the Sections 519 with the portion of the $350,000 for an annual survey of the disability service recipients. Do we currently do a survey today, and why is that? Is it necessary, rather, to do a survey every year for that kind of money?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, and we might need some help from Department of Human Services. Yes, they've started doing annual surveys, and it's just been a small number of people that they've surveyed, and we need to expand that, including the surveying that will be done by the Olmsted plan. There have been very few surveys done historically of people with disabilities. We're spending billions of dollars for these programs, and yet we're not really having a voice of those people receiving services being heard as to what needs to improve or what changes need to be. And so those surveys play a vital role in giving a voice to persons with disabilities.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So this is not necessarily the first of its kind, but it sounds like it's an expanded program of the survey. Is that correct?
Yes, we want to, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, yes, we want to see the expansion of the surveys included as part of the work of the State Quality Council, and to coordinate those efforts with the Olmsted Plan, which has called for even more intense surveys or widespread surveys than we originally had in this legislation.
And Mr. Larson, the Olmsted is a court order, if I remember right, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's a federal court order, and the Department of Human Services and other state departments are putting budget proposals together right now for the 2015 session in order to try to comply with the court order as the years go on here.
And Representative Liebling is involved with at least one part.
Well, Mr. Chair, are you talking about the MSOP issue? Yeah, it's separate, but indeed, it's related in the sense that we have federal, you know, we have somebody coming and telling us, you know, you've got your ways of doing things well, you better make sure that they are up to snuff with, you know, constitutional requirements. But it's really a different issue, but indeed the Olmsted order is something that we have to comply with as a state.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Liebling, I find your bill to be, seems like there's some very good components to it, and I'm a supporter of all what the state can do to help our disabled community. And, however, do you think is it necessary to have an annual survey of $350,000? You know, we throw numbers around so quickly around here and easily. $350,000 is still a lot of money, and it certainly can help a lot of people. I mean, $350,000, think of what that can help with the disabled community. So in your expert opinion, is it necessary to do it annually, perhaps a one-time survey to find out where we are and the services that we're providing and how effective and efficient they are? Maybe we should start with just one, and then I'll end with your comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. Well, I didn't write the language, and I think it's a very good question, and I hope Mr. Larson can answer it.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, yes, we need to survey on an annual basis. As again, I said, the $350,000, although an extensive survey, still is a limited percentage of the people that receive the services. We're behind from what other states are doing and from what the federal government, CMS, wants to be done as far as hearing the voice of people. And by doing it on an annual basis, we can see trends of where we're improving. or trends of where areas that we need to improve. And so it's very necessary with this larger program and the thousands of people that are being served that we take these steps.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that too. I know $350,000 it's a lot of money. It's not pocket change, but I don't know if anybody here has the figure about what we spend on these services in a year. And it's a lot, and you know, it's all relative. I mean, we spend a whole lot of our HHS budget providing these services, and I think that making sure that we're providing the right services in the right way is probably worth this amount of money, even though it does sound like a big amount.
Okay. You want to make the motion to lay it over? Or should I do that?
Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Okay. I would therefore move that House File 1897 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Let's see. Representative Loeffler.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1733 to bring it before the committee, and I have a DE1 amendment. And while people are gathering their papers, I'll just note that I will also need to make a small oral amendment to that DE1.
Okay, Representative Loeffler has moved the bill, and now she's moving the DE1 amendment, and she's going to do an oral modification of that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to incorporate into it a two-word addition. We need to add a verb into a line. It's on line 1.13, before poison control, to add in conducting. So that this section will read to cooperate with local public health agencies and the Department of Health in conducting poison control outreach and education efforts.
Any discussion of that oral amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the oral amendment is adopted. Now do you want to describe the rest of the amendment?
Mr. Chair, what this amendment does is it actually brings the cost down a little bit from what was originally proposed and clarifies that the use of it is to make sure that we enhance our staffing to meet national accreditation levels and outlines the other purposes for which these funds would be used. The second section asks the Department of Health to review the duties of the Poison Information Center and come back with recommendations to us in the future about the structure and funding of this vital part of our healthcare system. And so that is the components of the amendment.
Yeah. Okay, any questions on the amendment as amended? So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment as amended signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the amendment is adopted, and now we'll go to the overall bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling, this is a single statewide institution.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, our Minnesota Poison Information System is actually run under contract with the Department of Health by Hennepin County Medical Center, although the underlying statutes still reference regional systems, and I think that'll be part of the recommendation that'll come out of that study is to kind of update our statutes to reflect those kind of efficiencies. But it does serve the entire state of Minnesota. And one of the things you might want to look at is this handout that's in your packet. The second page of it is actually a map of the state of Minnesota, and it shows how we have gotten calls through to the Poison Information Center from every single county throughout the state. Unfortunately, these kinds of circumstances arise in many households, whether it's a senior who thinks they might have taken a second dose of something, or it's a parent who is in a panic because a toddler grabbed something and ingested it that they probably shouldn't have. And it basically it reflects the population. About half the calls come from the metro area and half from the rest of the state. You might be surprised to know that accidental poisoning is the second leading cause of unintentional injury death. And so it's a pretty serious thing, and time is of the essence. 51,000 people called in 2013, and our federal and state funding has not been able to keep up with the costs and threaten our quality. And to further explain that, we have Debbie Anderson, who is the director of the Poison Information Center, and I'd like her to share some further information with the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Anderson, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Poison Control System. And as Representative Loeffler said, it's a system that's hosted by Hennepin County Medical Center. So HCMC contracts with the Minnesota Department of Health to provide poison center services statewide. I want to thank you first for the $500,000 increase in the annual appropriation last session to cover poison center services. The funding is very much used to cover critical day-to-day costs of the program and is very much appreciated. I am here today because, unfortunately, the increase in the appropriation does not fully cover the cost of the program, and HCMC continues to fund the shortfall. With the intense cost pressures of the hospital, HCMC is finding it difficult to continue subsidizing the program. The lack of sufficient funding has the potential to jeopardize our national accreditation. National accreditation sets quality standards and is necessary to maintain access to critical federal grant dollars that help support the program. The Poison Center responds to calls from the public and healthcare professionals statewide, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, providing immediate, individualized medical assessment and treatment information for poisonings on a case-by-case basis. In 2013, over 51,000 calls from every county in Minnesota were managed by a highly specialized staff of toxicology experts. Prescription drugs, drugs of abuse, household products, and chemicals are a few examples of substances that both children and adults are exposed to daily and for which they need specialized care. In addition to the standby capacity available to all Minnesotans, the Poison Center is one of the most valuable resources that we have when it comes to illness and injury prevention and the public's health. It is well documented that every dollar spent on poison control services avoids an estimated $13.39 in unnecessary medical spending and lost productivity, saving Minnesotans over $32 million last year. 92% of poisoning exposures in the home are safely managed in the home through consultation with Poison Center staff, thereby preventing unnecessary healthcare visits and crowding of emergency departments. When we at the Poison Center survey our callers, 80% say that if the Poison Center wasn't available, they would go to the emergency department or a clinic. The Poison Center also provides critical public health surveillance and data. We are the first to raise the alarm about synthetic marijuana that was sold as incense or potpourri and about toxic products marketed as bath salts. We followed those warnings by actively collaborating with the health department to determine the health care burden of illicit synthetic drugs in the Duluth community. A summary of the project's findings about the high cost of bath salts was published by Minnesota Medicine last month and is included in your information packet. Doctors statewide have been asked to report all cases of synthetic drug exposures to the Poison Center to capture important data that can be used to figure out a solution to this ongoing problem. We have also identified health issues associated with packets of highly concentrated laundry detergents, and we have tracked the incidence of foodborne illness across the state. Public health officials rely on Poison Center data documenting exposures to e-cigarettes, tobacco products, pesticides, and carbon monoxide, and utilizes data in diverse efforts to keep all Minnesotans safe. As you're aware, overdose deaths from heroin and prescription opiates are on the rise. Ready access to naloxone, a medication that reverses the effects of these opiates, could prevent unnecessary deaths. The Poison Center is ready and able to provide 24/7 to provide immediate step-by-step assistance to individuals that find themselves in a position to provide care in an overdose. A quick call to the Poison Center would determine the need for naloxone administration, as well as instructions by trained professionals on how to give the medication. I would like to highlight the areas of our service where the additional $750,000 appropriation is needed to continue to provide and enhance the services of the Poison Center. We will ensure that our staffing levels meet national accreditation standards, which is necessary to maintain federal grant dollars. We will maintain healthcare provider toxicology education and training, as we have the only toxicology training program in the state. In 2013, 97 healthcare professionals were trained on-site in the Poison Center, and another 7,800 healthcare providers across Minnesota participated in professional education activities. We will augment current services with additional proactive public health surveillance of emerging health issues and increase data sharing and collaboration with public health partners. Finally, working with the public health partners and the Department of Health, we will target additional education efforts to children, disadvantaged communities, and immigrants to prevent poisonings and increase public awareness about the services of the Poison Center. We've had conversations with the Department of Health about the immediate need for additional funding and our concerns for long-term stable funding. Section 2 of the amendment asks MDH to conduct a study to determine the appropriate level of funding for the regional poison control system based on existing statutory obligations. It also asks the department to determine the benefits and savings generated by the Poison Center to the healthcare system, including provider systems, health plans, and the state. We believe this information would assist the state in developing a long-term vision and strategy for a healthy statewide poison control system. So in summary, the Poison Center's expert staff and 24/7 call center ensure immediate and cost-effective service for all Minnesotans when they need it. Poison Center data collection capabilities aid public health efforts and make our communities safer. HCMC is providing $600,000 this year to supplement state and federal funding to maintain nationally accredited program services, although the hospital is finding it increasingly difficult to subsidize this program. We believe that an additional appropriation is needed to ensure the long-term future of the Poison Center and the valuable services the program provides. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Anderson? I don't see any. With that, Representative Loeffler, I would move that the House File 1733, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the committee's time and interest in this life-saving preventive service. And I know many of you have contact cards that you provide to constituents, and if you don't have the Poison Information Center name on, phone number on that, you might consider adding it, because it can make a big difference in saving lives and preventing unnecessary use of our emergency rooms. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Moran. House File 1738, and she's just coming from another committee where she had another bill.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you all for the opportunity to present House File 1738 to the committee for consideration today.
Move the bill.
Oh, I need to move it. I'd like to move House File 1738, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
Okay, thank you. Care for someone with Alzheimer's or dementia disease at home is challenging and can take a toll on a person's health. Support for people caring for those with dementia disease can help caregivers remain healthy, and oftentimes results in a family member being able to stay at home longer. This bill before you today is about expanding the work taking place out in our communities, specifically the minority communities, to help those with Alzheimer's and dementia disease get quality family memory care services. and also support and educate our family caregivers who are on the front line helping take care of loved ones suffering from this debilitating disease. With me today is Paula Hart and Dorothea Harris from Volunteers of America to talk about the great work they are currently doing. I would like to turn it over to Paula Hart.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Paula Hart, and I'm President and CEO of Volunteers of America here in Minnesota. We are celebrating our 118th anniversary this week. We serve over 26,000 Minnesotans, including many seniors. So our interest is deep in helping address Alzheimer's, and particularly with the specific needs of minority populations. And I'm going to let Dorothea and Deborah talk more about the work that we're doing and the needs.
My name is Dorothea Harris, and I'm a licensed social worker with the Volunteers of America. I've been with the Volunteers of America for about 10 years now, and I'm real proud to say that I've been working with African-American caregivers for the entire time. And therefore, I see the need has increased for information, resources, to be out in the community. I'm glad to have the Alzheimer's Association here with you, with us, and I know that they are going to share some data. But the data that's coming out is saying that minorities are twice the risk for having Alzheimer's disease. However, minorities don't know that. And so there's not enough information and resources out there to help them, to support them, to let them know what the risks are that they are having towards Alzheimer's. Because minorities have high blood pressure and diabetes and high cholesterol, this is the high risk for the Alzheimer's disease. And we need to get that information out there. A lot of minorities do not even know the difference between healthy aging and Alzheimer's and just older aging. They compare older aging to just being Alzheimer's. And we understand that Alzheimer's is a disease and it needs to have medical attention. But because they're embarrassed and ashamed, thinking it's mental illness, they're not going to see the doctor and they're not talking about it. And we know that the medications that they have for Alzheimer's disease only works at the early stages. And all the years that I've been seeing families, I never see them at the early stages. It's always the later stages and when they're in crisis. And so I'm asking today if you would help me to get the information out to the minority population so they can begin to get some help, know where to go to, who to talk to find some resources. I have a senior aide, Miss Ellen, that's back there, and her and I did a presentation this weekend, Saturday, in St. Paul here at a church with 150 seniors. And they introduced me as the Black Alzheimer's Social Worker. After we got through doing the presentation for 2 hours, we had lines of people waiting to talk to us, to tell us about the peculiar behaviors that their families were having, not knowing that they're dealing with Alzheimer's disease. And so we have an epidemic on our hands out here. And Volunteers of America is working specifically with the minority population, and we need your help.
Okay. Is there another testimony? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Richmond, and I am the Director of Education and Outreach for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota, North Dakota. I am excited to represent the Alzheimer's Association here today in strong support of HF 1738. This bill will provide much-needed outreach to communities of color as well as other underserved minority groups on the topics of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. According to the 2013 Alzheimer's disease facts and figures, older African Americans are twice as likely to have Alzheimer's disease and other dementias as older whites. Genetic factors appear to not account for these differences in prevalence. Instead, health conditions such as high blood pressure and diabetes are believed to account for these differences in both African Americans and in Hispanics. There is also some evidence to suggest that lower levels of education and other socioeconomic characteristics in these communities may also increase risk. More than half of all Americans with Alzheimer's disease don't even know that they have the disease. In addition, there is evidence that misdiagnoses are more common among older African Americans and Hispanics than among older whites. A recent study of Medicare beneficiaries found that Alzheimer's disease and other dementias had been diagnosed in 8.2% of white beneficiaries, 11.3% of African American beneficiaries, and 12.3% of Hispanic beneficiaries. The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota strongly urges passage of HF 1738 to continue to fight this devastating disease. I appreciate your time today, and I am happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Quam, you got a question for somebody?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who has the information. What I'm after is, what is the current grant funding for dementia as a whole, so I have an understanding of the proportionality of this funding compared to the general funding, whether it be staff or Representative Moran.
We will try to find that out for you.
Thank you.
Very important. Certainly, this is more trying to ameliorate the thing at the start, and it's a huge expense at the end.
Yeah.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a very important issue. I appreciate the information brought forward. And I guess it's making me think about racial disparities funds at the Department of Health, what that money is currently being used for, do they have enough in their pot? You know, this is not the first. I carried a bill last year, as a matter of fact, and I know there are several others that members around the table have that address racial disparities in healthcare in different venues, whether it be women's health or dementia or any number of things. And I guess I'm needing some answers, and I don't see the department people here any longer. They were here earlier. I would really like a little bit more information on the broader topic of how much money we're currently spending just on racial disparities health issues, and are we focusing on the right things with the money we currently have? Is it all gone? Do you need more in that pot so that people don't have to come here with individual bills but have a department that they can go to that can fund these types of priorities? So, you know, it's my issues are, I don't think they're questions that the testifiers can answer, but they're just bigger global questions about how we're currently funding healthcare disparities in general.
Dave Greenman.
Oh, Dave's trying to sneak out. I saw.
Do you have any answers for us, Dave?
Or could you get them to us, perhaps?
And if
you
certainly, don't have them? Your department has just issued a report on ethnic differences in health status.
We could certainly get you some
information
about what resources we have.
Okay. Okay. Representative
Aver. Well, thanks, and I see a lot of health people have left, but I think the Department of Health has failed in their leadership here, and I think that the report, to me, is kind of vacuous. And I, with areas of autism and Somalis and so many areas that are of disparities involved, and I would keep hoping that they're going to take some leadership on this, and it's really good to have some Moran and your friends come forward to deal with these issues. And if they aren't gonna, then you have to do it this way. But these are, it's the Department of Health. And I just have been 16 years here, and I struggle with them day in and day out about getting to actually lead on this area compared to managing and sitting by on the sidelines. So keep pushing, and I will help. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Then I would move that House File 1738 be laid over for possible inclusion in the bill. And Representative Quam is going to move the minutes from February 27th.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
Wait a minute. Okay. I've just, we have one more testifier. If you could be very brief because we're over time.
Okay, I'll be very brief. My name is Ellen Johnson. I was a caregiver for my mother for 10 years, And my mother was diagnosed in Washington, D.C. with Alzheimer's. And I was very fortunate that the neurologist told me that when I moved her back to Minnesota to go to the Alzheimer's Association so that I would know what I would be dealing with to make my life and my mother's life bearable. And so I did go to the Alzheimer's Association, and I received a lot of education and a lot of resources. I also met a Hennepin County social worker that came to visit us and told us about a grant. It was called a health care grant, which was making my mother's life and my life better because I did have a lot of things that I could put her in, daycare, respite, da-da-da-da. And then I joined the Alzheimer's Speakers Group because I have been known as the Alzheimer's community person to go to if you want any information, because they had people that had things going on that they didn't understand. So I did address a lot of the community groups, but I didn't get to the minority groups. They didn't come out. And that's why I decided that I needed to have a support group. And so I started a support group in my home with six women. We had wine and the fireplace and food and everything, and it was really nice. Making them comfortable, that's the word, is making people comfortable to share their experiences. They may think they're small. And to know the difference between the senility and the disease. And so we've expanded a group, which is called Lil's Angels, after my mother. And we meet monthly, and we have really increased the group. So I just want to say that the word is out, but the word is by mouth, and that's not good enough. Word of mouth is good, but it's not good enough. We need to have something that will make the community be comfortable to come and get the information. There's a lot of information out, but not enough of the people, the right people, are not getting the information, which will make the caregiver's life bearable. Thank you for hearing me. Thank you.
And the bill has already been laid over for possible inclusion, and we're about ready to get done. So, Representative Quam, if you would move the minutes.
I would so move the minutes.
Okay, so the minutes have been moved. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the minutes are approved, and the meeting is adjourned.